supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Sleep. Ask your friends and family about how they've been sleeping these days while you're getting out and about this holiday season. You'll hear them say that they get to bed too late, they're tired, they're waking up early, they're waking up in the middle of the night, they can't get to sleep. Well, I'm one of them. I've had insomnia since my early adolescence until about 10 years ago, and the only way I could break free was I actually had a brain transplant, and I found it very helpful. But we're going to talk about that today, not brain transplants, but what we can really do for insomnia. There's lots of options we have. There's lots of new research about what we can do and what's available. Our guests are Dr. Michael Grander, Indira Gurubhagavatula. I did okay, Indira?
Yes, you did fine.
And Philip Gierman. Michael Grander is a clinical psychologist at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a member of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at the Center for Sleep and Circadian Neurobiology. Michael, welcome.
Thanks.
And Indira is director of the Occupational Sleep Medicine at Penn and director of their Sleep Disorders Clinic at the Philadelphia VA. Indira, welcome.
Thank you.
To the show. Phil is an assistant professor of psychology at the Perelman School of Medicine at Penn. He's a member of the Penn Sleep Center and at the Philadelphia VA. Welcome, Phil.
Thank you very much.
Our number, if you've got a sleep difficulty or a loved one does, 888-477-9499. 888-477-9499. Well, Indira, all of us have disordered sleep at some point in our lives, and for some of us it can last a while. So what's the difference between disordered sleep and a sleep disorder?
As you said, Dan, sleep disorders are very common, and the real question is at which point should somebody seek help and seek consultation from a specialist. I would say that if the disorder lasts, if it persists for longer than 2 weeks, if the person finds that they're sleeping a full 8 hours, 10 hours, and they're still waking up tired, still waking up unrefreshed, that's something that deserves medical evaluation. And just they're so common, the tendency for most people is to not talk about it and not report. And if they're dozing off during the day inappropriately, for example, people have a tendency to equate that with being lazy, and they don't want to come forward with it. Or if they snore, they think it's a sign that they're overweight or heavy, or that it's even normal. So we have way too much of a tendency in our culture to equate things as normal. So my advice to people is don't assume that. And if it's bothersome for longer than a couple of weeks, and especially if you're waking up unrefreshed, then talk to somebody.
Well, on the other hand, Michael, you said earlier that we don't feel the effects of sleep disorders, but they accumulate.
Yeah, sometimes that's true. We tend to be a pretty bad judge of how impaired we are due to sleep loss. We acclimate, or at least we believe that we acclimate, but if you look at the data, we really tend not to. So, like Indira said, the question isn't necessarily always about, well, when should I start asking for help? If you've gotten to the point where you're starting to ask that question, it's probably past the point where you should have been asking for help.
I'm curious, is it like other illnesses, Michael, that if you get it earlier, the chance of remediation is better, the prognosis is worse the longer it lasts?
Well, there are a lot of different types of sleep disorders, and the most common are insomnia and sleep apnea. So in the case of insomnia, the treatments for insomnia tend to be relatively effective across the board and across age groups. I mean, there's data on treating insomnia in young people that's showing it's very effective, and treating insomnia in older people can be very effective. Just the treatments, you know, change a little bit. In terms of sleep apnea, it's the same thing, where you can treat sleep apnea no matter how old you are, no matter how long you've had the disease, the treatments can still be very effective.
Yeah, I would add...
Yeah, Indira, what kind of sleep disorders are there? You know, Michael talked about insomnia. I thought that was it.
Oh, there are lots of sleep disorders. One of the commonest disorders we see is actually sleep apnea. And I was going to jump in and say the earlier we intervene for something like sleep apnea, the better. That's a disorder characterized by intermittent closure of the upper airway during sleep. And every time the airway either completely closes or even partially closes, there's a reduction in airflow. And so oxygen can't get in, and the level of oxygen can drop transiently. And that results in an arousal from sleep, a very brief arousal. It may not be a full awakening, so the person's not aware that they're waking up. And that arousal comes about because of a burst of adrenaline. And most of us know of adrenaline as a stress hormone. Mm-hmm. So people with sleep apnea are spending the night with brief arousals that can happen hundreds of times, drops in oxygen level, and lots of stress hormone during a period when they really should be resting. And long term, there are many, many consequences, including hypertension, heart disease, cognitive disorders, so loss of memory and concentration. You may not be your sweet, lovable, happy self. You may be a little more cranky, a little irritable, more road rage. The consequences are numerous. Every part of your body needs oxygen. Every part of your body needs rest, needs sleep, and a break from the adrenaline. So there is evidence that if this accumulates for a long time, that the blood pressure effects may no longer be reversible after a certain point, or that the cognitive deficits may not be reversible. So the earlier we intervene, the better.
Phil, I don't know if you can give us a context for sleep disorders, because it's only been seriously studied for a relatively brief period of time. Is there any data that can tell us that sleep disorders are getting worse or leveled out? Is there any way of knowing that? I'm curious.
There is some evidence that insomnia may be becoming more prevalent over time. You're right, we don't really have the long-term data that we'd like to have. We know from ancient writings that this is nothing new. I mean, the Bible talks about insomnia from several thousand years ago, but in terms of really having numbers about the actual prevalence, it's really just in recent years, but it may be going up. In terms of sleep apnea, given that it does have a strong association with obesity, as rates of obesity have gone up in our society, so have rates of sleep apnea as well.
What triggered this show, Phil, is a lot of articles are being written now about the relationship between sleep and depression. Mm. Traditional thinking is that a sleep disorder is a symptom of depression, mm-hmm. and that's pretty common, and it's still accurate, depression and other mental health problems. But now it seems that sleep problems put people at increased risk for depression. I wonder if a sleep disorder can even be causative. Can it cause a depression?
It's believed that it can in a number of studies. It's about 25 studies now showing that if you have insomnia, you're at about a fourfold greater risk of developing depression in the future. And while the strongest evidence is for depression, there are also studies showing you're at greater risk of developing anxiety disorders, of substance use disorders, even from some of my own work of post-traumatic stress disorder. And so it does seem to be the case that at a minimum, when you're not sleeping well, it makes your brain vulnerable to other problems coming up, and it may be that the insomnia itself is a direct cause in some cases.
This is important information, Michael. When somebody goes to a doctor or even a psychotherapist and they say, I'm depressed, the therapist sets out about treating depression, or the doctor gives them an antidepressant. But nobody asks about how's your sleep.
So it used to be the case that when you went to diagnose some sort of mental illness such as depression, you have a list of potential symptoms and you want to see how many criteria they meet. And sleep disturbance is frequently one of them. And if to diagnose insomnia as a separate disorder, it really had to be separate from that. Where if you had depression and insomnia was a part of it or maybe even caused by it, you would get a diagnosis of depression with insomnia as a symptom of the depression. But over the years, we have accumulating evidence that even if the depression came first and the insomnia came later, even though, as Phil mentioned, a lot of times the insomnia will come first, treating the depression doesn't make the insomnia go away, and it's because of how insomnia works.
And treating the insomnia?
Well, treating the insomnia fixes the insomnia, and there's also a lot of evidence showing that because sleep is tied to so many other systems, it could be that when you treat the insomnia, it could help the treatment in some of the other conditions. So, for example, it might help in if you have depression and insomnia. Treating the insomnia might not make the depression go away, but it might help. Same thing with other things that insomnia is associated with, like chronic pain. There's some evidence that if people have chronic pain, you know, they have trouble sleeping. And treating the pain can be very difficult. But if you treat the insomnia, you know, they might have a better experience with some of that pain.
Let's go to the phones. We've got Sean on the line. Hey, Sean.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks. What can we
Thank
do?
Thank you for having me on. I have a question. My wife experiences frequent and severe night terrors, and we're a little bit concerned about where to go and what to do about it. Anybody that she's spoken to has not encountered that. My wife's 30 years old, and they haven't encountered this in anybody but children, so we don't really have any direction for where to go for help, but we're really concerned about its impacts on her physically and being a danger to her.
I have a feeling you're not going to the right place. If people are telling you they haven't heard of an adult with night terrors, who wants to tackle that, Indira?
Yeah, I would ask, actually, what makes you think it's a night terror? What exactly are you observing?
Well, my wife often believes that someone is in the room or there is some imminent danger, and she shoots up screaming. And often will run out of the room into another part of the house if I'm not able to, kind of bring her to actual consciousness.
So
and in the process, she's, you know, banging into things, and after these episodes, her heart is, like, painful.
Yeah, this is something that really should be evaluated by a sleep specialist. There are a number of different possibilities as far as what this diagnosis is. But she needs a comprehensive review of some of the symptoms she's having by somebody trained in sleep disorders. So I would advise you to have her evaluated.
And I would advise you to go to a center, like the one, you know, these fine doctors are from at Penn. But, you know, there are many sleep programs around. I don't know if you're in Jersey. Cooper has one, Jefferson has one, I believe Temple has one. They're making faces here at the competition. But please take her to a program that can do a comprehensive evaluation. Any program you take her to, they will have heard of night terrors in adults.
There are a lot of really great programs in this area. Philadelphia is actually really lucky to have some of the best sleep centers in the country. To make sure that you know, there's sleep is one of these things that touches so many different systems. I mean, this would be an issue where you'd want to look for somebody who has a neurology background. So,
yeah, I would say that when you have a presentation like this, it could be an unusual presentation of a common disorder like sleep apnea, or it could be a typical presentation of an unusual disorder, something like what we call REM behavior disorder, for example.
Wait. REM behavior disorder.
Yeah, so REM sleep is rapid eye movement sleep, and that's where we do most of our dreaming. And typically what happens, the difference between non-REM and REM sleep is that in non-REM sleep, your brain is resting, but your muscles are active. And in REM sleep, the muscles are paralyzed throughout the body with the exception of the diaphragm, which does the breathing, and then the eye muscles, which kind of dart back and forth. But the brain is very alert and very active. They're sleeping, but if we were to hook up monitors to measure electrical activity, it would look like the brain is an awake brain. And we think a lot of dreaming happens then. And for some people, the muscle paralysis doesn't happen in REM sleep the way it should. So they may respond to dream content and jump up out of bed and run around and actually hurt themselves. So that, you know, that's one possible diagnosis. But to really get at the issue of what this is, she really should be evaluated by a sleep specialist and possibly observed in a sleep laboratory.
I want to talk about these sleep laboratories after the break and what options we might have with them. Let's see if we can get one more caller on before the break. We've got Teresa on the line. Hi, Teresa.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I work with an adult who has autism, and he's always had a terrible time sleeping. He's been taking melatonin almost his whole life. And in the past year or year and a half, it just doesn't seem to be working anymore. And his mood is suffering also. And I wonder, is there any type of treatment or anything that we could do that would help him keeping his special needs in mind?
Well, let's look into option, keeping in mind that we can't diagnose or treat on the radio, of course. But let's hear. Right. Phil, what are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, it is very common for people with autism to have difficulty sleeping throughout their lifespan. So it's not at all unusual. And there are two main categories of options. One would be more of the kind of medication route, whether it's something over-the-counter such as the melatonin, or there are a number of prescription medications that are used as well. Another option is to try to use non-medication-based strategies, which can be applicable to any individuals, which might relate to how you structure the bedroom environment and the sleep and wake schedule, what types of activities the person does during the day. It's hard to give some specific guidelines in a short period of time, but there are certainly both medication and non-medication options to help individuals with autism sleep better.
So how about if we do this, Teresa? You listen to the rest of the show, because when we come back from our break, we're going to talk about diagnosis and what we do in the sleep lab. But I also want to talk about treatment and what options we have. We touted at the top of the show non-medication treatment, so I want to look at those options too. We're talking about sleep and disordered sleep and its implications. We're talking with Michael Grander, clinical psychologist at the Perelman School of Medicine. All of my guests are with the sleep medicine program at Penn. Indira Guruvaguvtula, I screwed that up. I had it first. And Philip Gierman. Philip, did I get that right?
You did, yes.
Okay. We're talking about sleep disorders. And Indira is the director of the Occupational Sleep Medicine Program. She's director of the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the Philadelphia VA. Phil Gierman is an assistant professor of psychology at the Perelman School of Medicine at Penn, and he's a member of the Penn Sleep Center and the VA Sleep Center. Our number, by the way, is 888-477-9499. We'll be taking more calls after the break. 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb, and this is Voices in the Family here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, supports WHYY and is accepting clients at their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute has served the region since 1994 by providing treatment for psychological challenges, including depression, anxiety, and stress. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
My sleep last night was a little broken because I woke up about 3 or 4 times in the night to take care of my 1-year-old. Sometimes it takes me a little while to get back to sleep. I might be up for 15 or 20 minutes and then I'm back to sleep for an hour and a half, 2 hours, and then he's up again.
We are back on Voices in the Family. We are talking about sleep disorders with the people from the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program at the Center for Sleep and Circadian Neurobiology. I want to turn to you, Indira. What are some of the causes of sleep disorders, or is that too broad a question? I recall when I was having all those years of difficulty sleeping, falling asleep, I had a great deal of anxiety about going to sleep, and of course that made it worse.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. The reasons why we may see a sleep disorder develop, the reasons are as varied as the disorders themselves. As we talked about earlier, one of the commonest disorders is sleep apnea, and that's linked with obesity. It doesn't mean that every patient with sleep apnea is obese, but it is a common underlying risk factor. And any sort of psychosocial stressor, as we call them, any life change can precipitate insomnia. Whether it's a divorce or a job change or buying a new house or financial stress, having a new baby, it could be anything in the environment. If the person is, sleeping next to a noisy train track, for example, it could be a mood disorder. It could be a substance abuse problem. It could be a disorder related to what we call sleep hygiene. And sleep hygiene refers to all of the behaviors that either promote sleep or work against it. It could be shift work, that the person is working unusual or unconventional shifts. So lots and lots of reasons.
I want to talk, Michael, about sleep hygiene. We talked before our break. I promised we would talk about it. So I'll follow up on Indira's language. What are some of the behaviors that promote and interfere with sleep?
So maintaining healthy sleep has a lot to do with what you do during the day. So, for example, avoiding things that will interfere with sleep. So that means avoiding caffeine later at night. Things like heavy, spicy meals very close to bed can promote things like reflux, which can be worse when you're horizontal. Alcohol. A lot of people will drink alcohol thinking it helps them get to sleep, and to some degree they might fall asleep a little quicker, but the sleep they're going to get is a lot more shallow. Cigarettes, smoking. A lot of people might smoke to relax, but actually nicotine is a stimulant. It can make insomnia worse. Things like when you talk to people and they say, when I get into bed, I just can't turn my mind off. A lot of times what that has to do with is people not taking the time to work through whatever it is they need to work through before getting into bed, and that's the first chance their mind has where it's not being distracted by other things to think about what it needs to. So maybe it would be really important to take some of that time but do it out of bed. When you're talking about where do some of these sleep disorders come from, for example, with insomnia, a lot of times what happens is, like Indira mentioned, something happens that causes you to lose sleep. And when you spend a lot of extra time tossing and turning in bed because of whatever the original cause was, you can essentially kind of program yourself to be awake in bed when you should be sleeping. And so even when the original cause goes away, you're still in bed awake because you've programmed that. So you want to do things that help with that. So, for example, if you're laying in bed and you're tossing and turning and you're not able to sleep, one of the best things to do is just get out of bed and try again later. And you don't want to spend all that extra time in bed awake.
When I studied sleep disorders many, many years ago, the teacher said that the bedroom should be for reading, sex, and sleep. That's it. That's still the thinking?
Yeah, you want to minimize the amount of time you're in bed doing things that are not sleeping. because you don't want to create a situation where you essentially program yourself to be awake in bed rather than trying to program yourself asleep.
Indira?
I would add also that one of the biggest emerging reasons why people aren't sleeping in bed is because of handheld electronic devices, whether it's an iPad or a Nook or a Kindle or whatever it is. But people are getting a lot more screen time during times when they should be sleeping. And we think that the blue light that comes from screens is actually programming the brain to thinking that that's a time when they should be awake. So they may be inadvertently resetting their internal rhythm so that they're awake when they should be sleeping.
When should we shut them off, Doctor?
Well, obviously, any time when you're in the bedroom and ready to sleep is a time when a screen should not be on. And in the morning, when you're ready to get up is a good time. And we actually believe there's a role for light. So early morning when you first get up, and then in the evening, sometime between 4 and 6 p.m. are good times for us to have access to natural light, which has the right amount of blue light that we need to set our internal rhythms.
Phil, I want to look at the bigger picture with you, because we've been looking at the environment and not just the brain. But I wonder about things like food allergies. We alluded to digestive problems. And Chinese medicine suggests that insomnia is about the body, mind, and spirit not being in sync. So any research about these Eastern approaches like massage, acupuncture, yoga, meditation?
Probably the largest body of research is beginning to accumulate to support acupuncture as a treatment of insomnia. And there are a growing number of clinical trials showing that it can be pretty efficacious. There's a small amount of work that has been done on yoga as a treatment for insomnia. Beyond that, the evidence base starts to drop off pretty dramatically.
I want to turn to you, Michael. I've had a couple of sleep studies that we alluded to earlier. So I know how they work. But when a friend asked me, said he was going to go have a sleep study, he said, and he asked what it was like. And I said, I'll be honest with you. I said, it's not as bad as a colonoscopy. So that was the best I could say about what
I agree with you.
You agree. So, all right, Indira, isn't there a better way?
Well, there are emerging ways, new technologies. We love the in-lab studies because we can see lots of things. We can get lots of information. Now we have home testing strategies that are developing very, very quickly and that are available at our center, for example. So for routine bread and butter problems like sleep apnea, we can actually send people home with a monitor that they themselves hook up. And then we collect it the next day, and then we can review the data and find out very quickly if they have sleep apnea. For some of the more unusual sleep disorders, such as the one that the gentleman called about earlier, where we may actually have to do video monitoring or audio monitoring, then we would have them come into the lab and sleep there.
And in the case of insomnia, Michael, which is the most common sleep disorder, we actually usually don't use any kind of sleep studies. Usually that's diagnosed by having people track their sleep over a week or so using a diary, and we can use that to match against if we have any other objective measure. But we usually don't need a sleep lab test for insomnia.
I just a quick comment about apnea. We've talked about it a lot, and the treatment is these CPAP machines, and some of my patients rave about the CPAP and how it's changed their lives. The majority, though, of my patients hate it and don't use it. Mm-hmm. So what can we do for those majority? Indira?
Well, I think, first of all, going to a sleep center that offers comprehensive support and not just the diagnosis, but ongoing management and the care of sleep apnea, that's very important. So a center like that will have access to resources, whether it's lots of different kinds of masks that the person can try, or they can offer counseling and support to really target what is the issue that's keeping the person from using their machine and offered a very tailored intervention that's right for that person.
Could you describe the machine?
Well, the machine is basically a flow generator. and it blows air into the throat and keeps the airway propped open during sleep so that it doesn't collapse. And I tell my patients, think of it like a flat tire. So your windpipe is just like a tire full of air, and it has a tendency to go flat when you go to sleep.
What does it look like? What does...
The CPAP machine.
Yeah, what does it have to do?
It's about the size of a toaster. It sits on the bedstand. It generates air at a certain pressure level. It's connected to a hose, and there's a mask at the end of it that the person straps on. And you want a nice snug fit so there's no air leaking, and then you just turn it on and go to sleep. And nowadays, the machines have smart sensors, so they can actually titrate the amount of pressure that the person receives over the course of the night. So if during certain phases of sleep they're having worse apnea, then it'll give them more pressure. If they had alcohol that night and their apnea is a little worse, they'll get more pressure that night. And if they're in lighter stages of sleep and they're not having it, they'll have less pressure.
I read that more children are developing sleep disorders. Michael, are you seeing an increase in apnea in children?
Yeah, well, if you look at the prevalence studies looking in the population, it seems to be in kids there's two main causes of sleep apnea. One might be just the biology of the airway leads to these closures during the night. And in cases like that, it can be relatively easily treated sometimes with surgery. You can use surgery in adults, but it seems to be less effective. It very much depends on the person. Though surgery in kids, for example, removing adenoids can be very helpful. The other pathway where kids tend to get sleep apnea, and the reason, probably the main reason why it seems to be increasing, is tied to obesity. So obesity, just like in adults, as you gain weight, especially around the parts of your body that are taking in air, it tends to crowd the airway and make it a little bit tougher for the airway to be flexible, to expand, and as you gain weight, it can become harder to breathe at night. And so as we see an increased rates of obesity in adults and in kids, we can see increased rates of sleep apnea.
Hmm. Let's go on.
You mentioned earlier, Dan, that people were confusing depression with they were missing an underlying sleep disorder. With children, it tends to be ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
So kids disorders could manifest.
Absolutely. More and more pediatricians are becoming aware of that, and they're referring children with ADHD diagnoses to sleep labs to get tested and to rule out sleep apnea.
And what can be done for kids who have sleep apnea? I mean, you talked about surgery. Are they going to wear
CPAP,
these?
CPAP, yeah.
They're going to wear these machines?
Yeah, and a comprehensive weight loss program, which is not easy to do, given how easy it is to get calories in our society.
Right.
But CPAP therapy, and now the manufacturers that make masks are starting to offer a wider array of masks for children.
Good, good. Of course, the weight loss problem is a difficult issue, and especially in depressed neighborhoods where it's difficult to get access to good food. But that's a whole different topic. Let's go back to the phones. We've got John on the line. Hi, John.
Hey, hi, doctor. It's John in Rehoboth. I've been unable to really get a good night's sleep in over 5 years. I have to keep the radio on at night so I don't hear my regular heartbeat. And I never really go into a deep sleep, you know?
Why don't you want to listen to your heartbeat? What's happening?
Well, you know, when you're sleeping on a pillow, like if I hear my heartbeat, it just forms and gets me anxious. So I put the radio on, and, you know, it's like company, but I never get that deep sleep, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's not part of good hygiene. So the issue, now I'm gonna start off the discussion before we turn to are experts, but it sounds to me, John, that what you're saying, the issue is not your heart rate, it's your anxiety that's keeping you up.
Yes, Doc, I think you're absolutely right.
It's that emotion. All right, so now the question will turn to Phil. What do we do about chronic anxiety?
Yeah. So often people get stuck into these negative cycles where there's something that's interrupting their sleep. Then they become very focused on that thing and anxious about it, so that the moment they get into bed, they're actually now vigilant for whatever that may be, whether it's the sound of the heartbeat, whether it's sounds coming from the environment, whether it's thoughts coming into our mind, whatever it is. And the very fact of looking for those things, of course, we look for those things that we pay the most attention to. So it becomes a negative cycle that we get stuck into.
So it's where your focus is.
Exactly. And in fact, some people have argued that the very nature of insomnia is that it's taking an automatic process of falling asleep and making it something that we are now putting effort into. Because the harder we try to sleep, the harder it is to actually sleep. So a lot of what we do when we work with people with anxiety is try to use different strategies to try to decrease that focus on the sleep, to try to break that cycle so that people can fall asleep more easily and get deeper sleep.
How?
Yes.
How?
Well, a big part of it comes back to what Dr. Graner was talking about earlier, which is that anytime you're in bed and you're trying to sleep and you feel your mind is racing or you're just really trying very hard to sleep, sleep is not coming anytime soon. And so the best thing to do at that point is to get out of bed, do something relaxing until you feel ready to sleep again. Because the longer you lie there tossing and turning, it just makes it worse and worse.
I've also discovered in all of my research, personal and otherwise, that our demons they're nocturnal animals. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can keep them asleep during the day, but they're hungry at night. You know, mm-hmm. You get into bed with an exhausted body and there they come.
Yeah. And it's amazing how something can seem so anxiety provoking or stressful in the middle of the night that in the light of day in the morning, we look back and we ask ourselves, well, why was I so upset about that? And one of the things that we often have people do to reduce the likelihood of this happening is what we call setting aside a thinking time. So what you do is you set aside a time in the evening, 10 or 15 minutes or so, that you try to write down a list of all the things that are most on your mind that day. And what you're trying to do is kind of give yourself some time to focus on these thoughts, to get them out of your mind. And a lot of people find that when they make that part of their routine, they're less likely to dwell on those things when they're lying there in bed at night.
What would happen? I'm going to suggest, do we still have Michael on the phone? No, we've lost him. But I want to suggest to him, hoping he's still listening, something else. And Phil, I want to hear your opinion of what I'm about to say. But, the issue is focus. And I would like to see him approach his anxiety as a scientist would. Just be curious about what happens to his mind body when he gets into bed. Like, there's anxiety, and where in his body does he feel it? And notice the thoughts that go with it, but just notice the thoughts. And then notice other things that are going on in the room. Is there silence in the room? Does he notice that, or how the sheets might feel under him? Just notice what's going on in his life and be kind of an observer of what's happening in that bedroom and not just in it. I find that when I'm able to do that and I want to be an observer of what's going on, it doesn't last very long. I fall asleep.
Yeah. I think that's a great suggestion. So often when we start having those anxious thoughts, we get wrapped up into them, and it's very difficult to break that cycle. But when we can start to take a step back from those thoughts and just to, like you said, to observe them, to notice what we're thinking, notice what's going on around us, by taking that step back, it helps to avoid getting sucked into them.
When we're going to take a short break, when we come back, I want to talk about CBTI, which is all the rage these days and seems to be very effective. It's cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. My guests today are Michael Graner, clinical psychologist at the Perelman School of Medicine. He's a member of the Behavioral Sleep Medicine Program. Indira Gubaguvatula, better that time? Thank you. She is director of the Occupational Sleep Medicine at Penn, and she directs the Sleep Disorders Clinic at the Philadelphia VA, and I want to talk about sleep and PTSD, too. Phil Gehrman is assistant professor of psychology at the Perelman School of Medicine. He's also at the Sleep Center at the Philadelphia VA Medical Center. When we come back, we're going to take some calls. We're going to talk about what we can do. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. Alzheimer's is not curable, but prescription medications can sometimes help to maintain the quality of life for longer periods. Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a research study to test a new investigational medication for patients with a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 610-277-8073. 610-277-8073 or keystoneclinicalstudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, our pop culture critic Renee Graham joins us and says the most exciting films are not coming from Hollywood, they're coming from Korea.
They're incredibly original. They cross genres, there's a lot of dark humor, there's action. I just think they're fantastic.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
I have a roommate who gets up at 4 something in the morning and leaves by 5, so that usually wakes me up. And then I go back to sleep for like an hour, and then my alarm goes off, and then I go back to sleep for half an hour. It's pretty ridiculous. I've always had trouble getting to sleep, so it's even worse once I wake up in between.
And that's exactly what we're talking about today on Voices in the Family. We're talking about sleep disorders. And before our break, I wanted to talk about I mentioned CBTI, and all three of my guests got this really happy, jumpy thing about them. So who to turn to first, Phil?
So CBTI is short for Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Insomnia. And it's the most empirically supported treatment for insomnia. And I think the reason we all got excited is because we do a lot of it, and we know it works very well. About 80 to 85% of people respond to this type of treatment. But it's really only in recent years that the word is really getting out about this type of treatment as an alternative to medications. And so we always get excited when people are talking about it.
What is it? What does it look like? How long does it take?
So it's a very structured form of therapy. It consists of a handful of different strategies, some of which we've really already been talking about today. So getting out of bed when you can't sleep. Sleep hygiene is one component of this treatment. Dealing with people's thoughts about their sleep. It's a number of different components. What a typical course of treatment looks like is usually between 4 to 8 weekly sessions. And so it's relatively brief compared to most forms of therapy. And the majority of people, as I said earlier, by the end of those 4 to 8 sessions are on their way to getting a better night of sleep.
And continue, though. You talked about basically education, which clearly is important, and most people don't have it. But what else happens in those 4 to 8 weeks? Or are they given exercises, practices, homework?
So what we're often trying to do is figure out what are those factors that are keeping this individual's insomnia going for this person's cycle? What's driving it? And we'll pick certain strategies to match their particular presentation. And so what we'll usually do is, earlier the idea of a sleep diary was mentioned. So we'll send people home to start keeping track of their sleep. And that information helps us to then assign different strategies to them, which they will then practice for a week. Come back, we'll give them some more strategies and build over time.
So you're doing that is very similar to what I suggested to the other caller. You kind of get out of your thoughts and you become the observer of your own life, your own sleep pattern.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm a big believer that one of the ways this treatment is effective is it helps people to see that they're not helpless when it comes to their insomnia. There is something they can do about it to begin to take charge of their sleep again.
One of my concerns, and I'll turn to you, Michael, is Phil alluded to this earlier, and sleep is natural, and it's about letting go. And my concern is that we're telling them all the things they need to do to achieve, to accomplish, which is kind of counterintuitive. It doesn't sound like letting go. It sounds like harder work.
So that's a really good question. And to expand on what Phil was talking about, one of the goals of CBTI, and the difference between CBTI and just kind of looking up tips online and making some slight changes to your sleep schedule, is that when you go through, you know, again, it's only 4 to 8 sessions of CBTI, and again, people could have been suffering for insomnia for a long time, so it's really not that much time it takes for the majority of people to get on the road to getting a lot better. But one of the main goals is really reprogramming your sleep schedule. So we mentioned before about how a lot of times people program their brain to be awake in bed and to be focusing on all these things, and you train yourself to be focusing on these things, and you create these cycles. And the goal of CBTI is really to take a structured, formal approach guided by somebody who's kind of an expert in this area, who really knows their way through this, to get you to really reprogram your sleep. A lot of times it has to do with changing up your sleep schedule and changing when you're getting into bed, when you're getting out of bed, and what you're doing when you're in bed, in a way that at first it might seem like, you know, there's work involved, but eventually you see that it's the goal is to take that burden off of you, at least when you're in bed. If you're going to do these things, if you're going to be worrying about these things, figure out things that you can do out of bed to deal with them, or very quickly in bed.
Where do we find such a person? We know at Penn. Where else can we find such a person? Is it common for people to practice CBTI?
It's becoming more common. Unfortunately, there are not a lot of individuals with a specialized training in this area. A good resource is often the Society for Behavioral Sleep Medicine, where there is a list maintained of people by state and who specialize in this type of treatment. So that's often a good place to start.
That's really helpful.
So that's behavioralsleep.org.
Behavioralsleep.org.
Yeah, you can see, and anybody can go up and see a list that's relatively well-maintained around the country, and there are even some international entries of people who specialize this. And we're lucky that in Pennsylvania in particular, and then specifically in southeastern PA, there's actually still only a handful of people who specialize in this, but more than a lot of other areas of the country. So we're very lucky here.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Nina on the line. Hi, Nina. Nina?
Hello? Yes, hello, thank you. Is nocturnal enuresis, which continues as an adult, part of a sleep disorder, or is it a chemical brain disorder?
You want to tackle that, Nira, and will you define it, nocturnal enuresis?
Nocturnal enuresis is the process by which a person has the urge to urinate during hours when they should be sleeping, and sometimes they may actually be unable to maintain continence. They may be incontinent when they're in bed.
That's different from an aging bladder.
It not necessarily. I mean, it when you say enuresis, it's a broad set of conditions, and it could be an aging bladder, it could be a prostate issue, it could be congestive heart failure or diabetes, or it could be sleep apnea. So the reasons why somebody may have a bladder issue at night could be any of those, and they again should be evaluated by a specialist.
And
or at least start with an internist, and if they feel a sleep disorder is contributing to the problem, then they should be referred.
You know, I made a joke in the beginning of the show about my insomnia being cured by a brain transplant, but in all seriousness, it was cured by medication and not hypnotic, not a sleeping pill, but an old-fashioned antidepressant, trazodone, and I take a fairly hefty dose of it at night. I've got a history of 3 major depressive episodes, so I'm going to need to be on baseline antidepressant anyway. And it made a world of difference. So any of you want to address the role of medication? Phil?
Sure. Medications certainly have their role. I'm a big believer in giving people as many options as possible. And so for some people, a medication option is what they would prefer. The downside of the medications is for most individuals, and it sounds like this is the case for you, you have to keep taking it in order to continue to get the benefits. You're usually talking about long-term use with medications. For that reason, when people feel up to doing cognitive behavioral therapy, I often recommend that approach because when it's effective, it fixes the problem usually for the long term. But generally, both approaches have their role.
So what happens when somebody takes sleeping medication over the long haul? Anybody?
It's really varied. Some people can successfully take medications for years, and they continue to be effective. They don't have significant side effects.
I'm not talking about these antidepressants. I'm talking about what we hear advertised on TV.
Yes. And for other people, they become less effective over time because they develop tolerance to them. And so it varies from individual to individual.
Indira, you talked about REM sleep earlier, the deepest sleep that we need. Do these medications, these so-called hypnotic sleeping pills, do they affect the quality of sleep?
They can, depending on the agent that's being used, and some of them will never mimic natural sleep. Pharmacologic sleep isn't always as deep or as restful, as restorative as natural sleep. Mm. But the newer agents are, that's the goal of the newer agents, is to try to keep sleep as natural as possible. What people don't realize is that when we sleep, that sleep has what we call an architecture, and that our brain moves through different phases of sleep in a very organized and systematic way. So we start off in light sleep, and we gradually get into deeper sleep. The non-REM phases that we talked about earlier, when we get to deep non-REM sleep, and if someone wakes us up out of it, we're confused, we don't know where you are. That's a beautiful restorative sleep. And then eventually we get to REM sleep. So, and REM we cycle into every 90 minutes, and successive periods of REM get longer and longer, and we think our dreaming happens during those phases. And why we have this organized like this, why it's conserved across species, we don't really know, but that's what we want to get. That's what natural, healthy sleep looks like.
And some of the medications suppress some of the really deep non-REM sleep as well as REM sleep. So, you know, it all has to do with your individual choice in terms of what option works best for you. There's pros and cons of any of the options that are out.
Yeah, we talked earlier about sleep being a process of letting go, and I think you really touched on a very broad societal thing that we deal with, which is letting go, and we're not moving in that direction. If anything, we're moving towards overscheduling ourselves, and we're extending that culture to our children. So, you know, adolescent children that should be sleeping and getting their 9-10 hours a night are instead up late into the night doing homework. They're overscheduled. They have activities and sports and clubs. They're up early.
We are not taking good care of our bodies, our brains, or our spirits, and we all have to make that a priority. I want to thank all three of you so much for joining us. It's an important show and a valuable one. Next week, we're going to be preempted by the WHYY radio play. We'll be back on December 30th with Stephen Post talking about the gifts of giving. Well, to download our podcast, go to whyy.org/voices. We are on Twitter at Voices in the Fam, and I am at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Hey, enjoy your week, my friends. Rest well.